Yep, Parshas Pinchas 8:76. But so in this parsha, there's a number of different things. The one I want to focus on more is the first part of the parsha, because it actually comes in continuation with last week's parsha. Bit of a complicated topic. So what I'm actually going to do is do the other way around. I'm going to actually just briefly touch on a few other things in the parsha and then come back to the beginning, okay? Because it's all a bunch of different things. So first thing to have a look at, just to highlight that in this week's parsha, is on page... where are we? Page 884, the top. And it's the parsha of dividing up the land. This parsha takes place, the next couple of parshas, until the end of the Chumash really, is where the Yidden at the very end, they're at almost about to go into the land of Israel, right? So we have, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Lemer, Hashem speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu saying, Lo'ele techolek ha'ores, to these people you shall divide the land, benachalo, with an inheritance, v'mispar shemois, according to the number of names, in other words, according to the number of people, you should divide up the land of Israel. L'rav tarbe nachalosai, for the many, you shall increase its inheritance. V'lama'it ta'amit nachalosai, ish lefi pekudav, each person according to his numbers, yutam nachalosai, his inheritance shall be given. In other words, bigger tribes got bigger portions of the land of Israel, bigger families got more, etc., and it was done on one hand in a very logical way. On the other hand, we have a next interesting pasuk that says, "Ach begoyrel yechalek asaretz." However, you should do it by way of lottery, right? Like a draw lots. L'shmois matei avosam in cholu and divided the land according to the names of their fathers' houses. It says again, "Al pi agoyrel, according to the lottery, techalek nachalose shall the inheritance be divided, bein rav limaot, whether many or few." In other words, a very interesting combination here. On the one hand, there's a very logical process to dividing up the land of Israel. Bigger portions for bigger tribes, smaller portions for smaller groups, which makes perfect sense. But then the Torah emphasizes it's got to be done by lottery, which is a very strange thing. Normally things are done by lottery don't have to make sense. Right? So, and also, the lottery would not necessarily come out the same way as the logical process, right? Which is a bit of a contradictory. So Rashi, of course, tells us that the lottery was Ruach HaKodesh, was done by divine providence, and in fact the lottery fitted exactly the process and there was no discrepancy. But it still seems strange why there should need to be a lottery, so the Mepharshim
explains.
It was divinely rigged. It was divinely rigged, if you can say it that way. Yeah. Well, no. The reason, no, it wasn't really fair. There's a deeper reason, I think. The reason is because lottery, the concept of lot symbolizes a super-rational sort of process, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the process of dividing up the land of Eretz Yisrael is indicative of the existence of Klal Yisrael in general. That on one hand, we need to do whatever it takes strategically and naturally to survive and exist in this world. On the other hand, to be conscious of the fact that our existence really is supernatural and it doesn't happen through the natural means, but it's completely miraculous. And you see those two things come together in the dividing up the land of Israel, where on the one hand it was a natural process, a logical, rational process. On the other hand, it was specifically done by way of lottery, because lottery, the symbol of lottery, is an illogical, irrational sort of symbol, and that's the existence of Klal Yisrael, which is irrational because it's miraculous. So I think that's the... Then the next part, we won't do it inside, but the next part is the famous story of the daughters of Tzlafchad, right, who approached Moshe Rabbeinu because the laws of inheritance worked through the sons, and they didn't have, and their father had already died. It's the whole machlekes, the whole dispute exactly who Tzlafchad was. Some say he was the guy who piled up the wood on Shabbos and therefore was killed, or some say he was part of the people that attempted to go into the land of Israel after the Meraglim, and they were beaten back and he was killed. Wherever he wasn't around, and they were afraid that they would lose their portion of the land of Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't a real estate issue, it was a love of the land. We were taught they were great, they were very smart, they were clever people, and they were tzidkonis, they were righteous women. And they came up with this whole thing that why should we lose out in the land of Eretz Yisrael? And it was then that Hashem responded that the laws of inheritance are such that if there's no sons, it goes to the daughters. And therefore they did in fact receive a land of in Eretz Yisrael. There are three instances in the Torah, by the way, where people's initiative, so to speak, brought about an extra portion in the Torah. One was Yisro, who came up with his plan of delegation, of middle management. And he suggested that became inscribed in the Torah, became written in the Torah. The second was, the second two actually were extra mitzvah almost. Was the story of Pesach Sheni when the people approached Moshe Rabbeinu saying that we lost out on the korban because we're impure, and Hashem says, and Moshe Rabbeinu says I have to consult God, and the response is a new mitzvah that gets recorded in the Torah, the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach, which is brought in the second month, and then this thing about the complaint of the daughters of Tzlachot, what do we do about losing the portion of land, and then as a result there's a new halacha, and the halacha is that it should go to the daughters. The halacha would have been anyway, so to speak, but they were great people, and therefore they merited that it should come, they should facilitate the revelation of this halacha ultimately. Okay. Then we have a very interesting part of the parasha. A lot of different things happen in this parasha. I just said we're doing a few parts of the parasha, then we're going to go back to the beginning afterwards. If you have a look on page 888. Pasuk Tezvah, verse 15, it's the beginning of the paragraph. We have a very interesting request from Moshe Rabbeinu to God. And the pasuk starts off very interesting. Pasuk by Vayedaber Moshe el Hashem Lemer. Oh, welcome back. Page 888. Vayedaber. Now, normally, we normally are very familiar with the pasuk that comes up all over the Chumash, which we read as Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe Lemer, right? Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, right? Here we have the opposite around. You realize that? Vayedaber Moshe el Hashem Lemer, right? And it's interesting because the word Vayedaber actually means very clear, sort of firm language. And here's how Moshe in his turn to talk to God and say, listen, I've got something to tell you, right? I've got a command for you, so to speak. What is it? It's Yifkad Hashem Elokei Haruchais. God, the God of all spirits, should appoint someone L'chol Basar Ish Al Ha'eda. Sorry, my grammar was wrong. Yifkad Hashem Elokei Haruchais L'chol Basar. Hashem, who is the God of spirits of all flesh, should appoint a man upon the congregation. Right? Should appoint someone upon the congregation as a leader. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu accepted that he's not going to go into Eretz Yisrael. He's not going to be the leader. This is almost the final days. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, I need to pass over that leadership to other people. Please appoint another leader. Right? Asher yetze lifnehem v'asher yovel lifnehem. He should go out before them, come in before them. Asher yetzim, yeshivim, you take them out, bring them in. V'leitiyo ka'adas Hashem. And the congregation of God shall not be katsoin like a flock asher ein lohem roya that has no shepherd. Okay? And as a result of that, Hashem says to appoint Yahushua. Yahushua will be the next leader, and there should be sort of a handover kind of thing, right? Now, in this parasha, Moshe Rabbeinu used a very interesting expression. First of all, it's an amazing thing. Moshe Rabbeinu has been the leader of Klal Yisrael for over 40 years. He is coming to an end, and he's worried. He's a dedicated leader, and he's worried that they will be left without a leader, so he almost demands kind of thing from Hashem that he should appoint another leader, and it should be someone that's appropriate to lead Klal Yisrael. But in doing so, he also gives us a little bit of a glimpse into true leadership. And in doing that, the leadership perhaps that we can take from this, not leadership over a whole congregation, but every person in their own leadership, whether it's a parent or a teacher or whatever the case, right? He says that Hashem should appoint another leader, right? But he doesn't just say, Yifkad Hashem Ish Al Eida, that God should appoint a person upon a congregation. He refers to God in a very unusual term. He refers to God as Elokei Haruchais L'chol Basar, the God of the spirits of all flesh. See that? What does he mean by that? What is he alluding to? So Rashi says that what he was saying is like this. He's talking about the type of leader you need to appoint. Because Ruach means like a spirit, right? And Moshe Rabbeinu was saying that we need a leader that will be able to cater and accommodate and incorporate the spirit of every single individual, right? Ruach l'chol echad v'efer. Everyone is different. Everyone's an individual.
Every level.
Every level, every personality, every perspective, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was saying that I was a leader of a Klal Yisrael and I realized that everyone is different. Everyone's individual. Elokei haruchos l'chol basar. The God of spirits of all flesh, right? You see, it doesn't say ruchos in the plural, spirits of all flesh. In other words, every flesh is different. Isha sheruach boi. Moshe Rabbeinu is saying that it needs to be someone who is able to cater and to focus on the individuality of every single individual. Because a true leader is someone who doesn't want to mold everyone into thinking like he or she does. A true leader is someone who's able to lead every individual according to their own individuality. Obviously, there's a common value system, there's a common goal, there's a common direction, and that's part of the leader's job as well. And that's actually part of the difficulty of a leader, because on one hand, the leader has to create that commonality and a common focus, and therefore impress upon everyone that there has to be a common focus. On the other hand, how to express that common focus, how to reach that common focus on the destination, there's a very, very strong individual path, and that's why it needs to be someone who can really understand individually everyone. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu meant. And he's alluding to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When you appoint a leader, it's got to be, as he says later, Isha Sheruach Bo. It's got to be someone who really has the capacity to cater to everyone's individual spirit. All right, so that's that part of the parasha. Then, have a look at page 890. All right. We have the famous part of Parshas Pinchas, which is dealing with all the sacrifices. What type of sacrifice we're talking about? Not the same sacrifice that was dealt with at the beginning of the book of Vayikra, but these are communal sacrifices, right? And it starts off in Chamishi with the daily sacrifice, the one that's called the Korban Tamid, the constant sacrifice, the one that has to be brought every single day in the Beis HaMikdash, one lamb in the morning, one lamb in the afternoon. And then it starts off with what we call all the Musaf, the additional sacrifices that are brought on special days. If you have a look, for example, if you have a look on page 890 towards the bottom, Pasuk Tes, verse 9, it says, right, Uva Yoyma Shabbos, on Shabbos, Shnei Chavasim B'nei Shonat Mimim, there should be two sheep, two lambs, which are about a year old, Ushnei Shonim, and two tenths of flour, Sarah Mimim, Vashem Niskoy, mixed with oil and the libation, etc. Then the next Pasuk starts with Rosh Shech Hachechem, what you need to do on the Rosh Chodesh. If you have a look on the page after that, right, it talks about Pesach and Bikurim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. This, by the way, is the most often read part of the Torah. Why? Because we read every Rosh Chodesh. That's the right. That's the Torah reading for Rosh Chodesh. Every Yom Tov. That's the Machti. When we take our two Sefer Torahs and we, oops, let me just. When we take out two Torahs, right? How does the Torah reading work every Yontif? When we take out two Torahs, the first Torah we read something like to do with the story of the Yontif or the laws of the Yontif, whatever the case is. And the second Sefer Torah we always read for Maftir, we always read the portion that deals with the special sacrifice that were brought on that day, the Musaf. Right? And we quote this in Musaf, when we daven Musaf. We quote these psukim. You'll notice that if you look at the davening, every Shabbos we quote the one for Shabbos, every Rosh Chodesh we quote the one for Rosh Chodesh, every Yom Tov we quote the one particular to that Yom Tov. So it's the most often repeated and often read part of the Torah, I think. All right. Because we read multiple times, on the Yom Tov we read many times. In fact, there's an interesting question. There's a place to someone in Gemara who asks the question, why would I do the same thing on Shabbos? Like, why don't we take our two Torahs every Shabbos? And read the Parsha in the one, and then from after, read the Korban, read the Musaf. I think the answer is because it's only two Psukim, the Shabbos one, and we sort of, that doesn't work. Because for an Aliyah, you need three Psukim at least. I mean, for memory, that's one of the answers at least. Anyway. Okay, so there you have a glimpse of all the different things in the parasha. So as I said in the beginning, now I want to go back to the beginning of the parasha and deal with that more extensively. Beginning of parashas Pinchas is actually a continuation of the end of parashas Balak. It's a very, very complicated piece. And in understanding who Pinchas was, we enter into very dangerous territory. Let's understand the background. We need to have a look at the end of the previous parasha on page 874. The background to the story is Bilam fails, right? He comes to curse the Jewish nation and it doesn't work. Where are the nation? Where are Am Yisrael? Am Yisrael now in a place called Shittim. Shittim is one of the last, in fact, or the last stop before they go into Eretz Yisrael, right? Just on the other side of the Yarden Yerechai and on the other side of the Jordan. So Bilam has one last crack at it. He advises Balak to entice the Jewish people to sin. He says, there's no way I can penetrate, there's no way I can curse them. But if you can get them to fail, and fail in fundamental issues, they'll make themselves vulnerable to the punishment of Hashem. So Balak thinks that's a great idea. So he opens up, he exploits, actually you could say, the daughters of Midian, sends them off to the Jewish people to entice them, and there's two goals. One goal is to get them to engage in immoral sexual behavior, and the other goal is to get them to serve idolatry. Right? And it was done together. What used to happen is that these girls would come and they would befriend the Jewish males, who would then fall for them, and as they were getting closer, more intimate, they would pull out these little getchkas, these little idols, and they would get them to engage in pagan worship of the worst kind, called the Avodah Zorah of Pe'or, which is one of the lowest forms of idol worship. Right? So it works. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is angry and he starts a plague. Right? And people fall. There were 24,000 people that fell in that plague. Part of the story happens where it gets to the point where there's a terrible Chilul Hashem, where the leader of the tribe of Shimon falls for the trap. Okay? And he, what's his name again? Zimri ben Sol, he was the leader of the tribe. Zimri was supposed to be a reputable person, and he is caught by Cosby Bastur, who is a dignitary from the Midianites. She's a princess, and you know, they sent the princess to chop the leader, and it works, and he does it in an incredibly chutzpahdik way. In fact, he approaches Moshe Rabbeinu, and he brings her along, and he says, is this girl permitted to me or not? Moshe Rabbeinu says, she's not permitted, so he starts to laugh. He says, well, that's the case, how was your wife permitted? Your wife also comes from Midian, and it was a terrible sort of threat to Moshe Rabbeinu, and it was a terrible chil Hashem. Obviously, the answer was obvious. Moshe Rabbeinu's wife converted before Matan Torah, and it was different. It wasn't a defiance against HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his mitzvahs. But before the giving of the Torah, it was completely different, of course, etc. So all of a sudden, there's this guy Pinchas. Pinchas, we never hear him before. Pinchas is the son of Elazar, who's the son of Aaron. So he's Moshe Rabbeinu's great nephew, and he's a zealot. Right? He sees what's going on, and he remembers the halacha. And the halacha says, "Haboyal aramis," that if someone lives intimately with a non-Jewish woman publicly, causing a desecration of Hashem's name, although technically it's not an offense which is capital punishment in court, but it's open to the zealots. Such a halacha, kanoin poigin boy. He who is truly zealous for God's sake can take care of this guy. Right? And he takes upon himself this mission. He says, we've got to put a stop to this. He's getting completely out of hand. Kal Yisrael on a slippery slope down. He wants to take care of it. He approaches Moshe Rabbeinu and he says, didn't we learn from you that in such a case the zealous may stand up and take action? Moshe Rabbeinu says, well, if you're the guy bringing it up, by all means, I mean, you're the guy, you know, as Rashi says, you're the person bringing it up, you live up to it, say that. It says, Vayar Pinchas saw, Vayikach Roimach Beyodo, he took a spear in his hand, walks into the tent, kills Zimri and Cosby. The Gemara says, tremendous miracles happened to him, walks around the camp with them, so everyone should see what he's done, and the plague stops. Right? Now, Why I say it's dangerous territory is because zealousness is a very dangerous topic. Right? It's a dangerous topic because the motivation really is important. Right? And we're going to see this in a second, because Pinchas' motivation was then questioned. We'll see how in a second. What he did was praised by Hashem. What he did was accepted. What he did was rewarded. Okay? Hashem understood, Hashem accepted that what he had done was sincere. He had done it only for no ulterior motives whatsoever. He had done it only for the sake of Hashem. He had no evil intention. He had no zealous intention other than standing up for God and God's name and the desecration of Hashem's name. And therefore he was rewarded with a reward we'll soon look at. Right? But it's not like any other mitzvah, you see. When a person does a mitzvah, motivation and intention is always important, but it's not critical. Right? Even learning Torah, the Gemara says that a person should learn Torah even if it's not for the right reason, not for its pure sake. Because eventually they'll come to learn it for the right reason. Same thing with tzedakah, same with any mitzvah really, right? We don't say a person should not light candles on Shabbos or not put on tefillin or not eat matzah if they don't have pure intention, right? Let's say a person happens to like matzah. Not many people do. But let's say a person likes matzah. When he eats matzah, he eats a bit more, you know, he's eating it because he loves it. Maybe his intention is not completely pure. Or you get someone to do a mitzvah, you get someone to drink 4 cups of wine. Maybe they like wine. Maybe they're not doing it only for the sake of that, right? So we say, it's not ideal, but it's not critical. At least you're doing the mitzvah. You're connecting. Every mitzvah connects you with like a little one. But there are some mitzvahs that intention is critical. And if the intention is not there, not only is intention missing, but the whole thing changes. And it's no longer a mitzvah, right? One, the ultimate example of this is Pinchas' actions, right? To stand up for God, to take action, a type of action Pinchas took, which is to kill someone, right? Essentially that's what he did, he killed someone, right? Which, there was a legitimate cause, because that was the halacha, but it's the type of thing that you really have to mean it. In other words, if you're doing it purely for God's sake, it's a praiseworthy action. If you're not, you're a murderer. Simple as that. Right? So, there are many lessons one can learn from Pinchas, and bravery, standing up, being proud, being conviction, etc. But one has to be very cautious before you take it to Pinchas' degree. Right? Because intention is very, very important. Okay? I want a little word like this. If you have a look, again, it's still on page 874. Right? Pasuk Zion, verse 7. It says, Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron HaKohen, saw what was going on. Vayokom mitecha edo, and he got up from among the congregation. Vayikach roimach beyodoi, and he took a spear in his hand, and he went and he killed it. So I once heard from an uncle of mine, this pasuk gives away the secret of how we know that Pinchas' intentions were pure. Because it says that he saw what was going on and then he took a spear. They say some people walk around a whole day with a spear. Like, where can I kill next? Like, you know, I need an excuse to kill. And then they'll dress it up in some sort of religious activity, right?
Like ready to snap at people.
Yeah, so someone he has to fight with someone. So I need a good excuse, so I'll do it in a way where it looks very religiously praiseworthy. Pinchas wasn't like that. Pinchas wasn't a man of the spear. He was a peace-loving person, as we're going to see in a second. Right? But how we know that his intentions were completely pure is because by Yar Pinchas, he saw what was happening. The call of the Yar was to take action. No one was taking action. Action needed to be taken. There was a plague. There was a complete desecration of Hashem's name. People were dying. People needed to do tshuva. They needed to reverse the cycle. So there was no other choice. So he got up and then he took the spear. When you need to, you take a spear. If you have to, that's what you do. Right? And that's what he did. Okay. But it wasn't that simple. That's what the Torah tells us what happened, but he was questioned. Now let's see first how he was questioned. Hashem rewards it. Okay. Now we the beginning of Parashas Pinchas, page 876. We're just gonna learn a bit of the simple pshat, then I'm gonna take you on a very deep journey. Vayadaber Hashem Moshe Leimer, Hashem speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu saying, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron HaKohen. Heishiv es chamasi. He turned my anger back me'al b'nei Yisrael. In other words, my anger was let loose. He turned it back. He contained it. Bekanayas kinasi b'soichem, because he was jealous, he was zealous for my vengeance, so to speak. V'loy chilisias b'nei Yisrael b'kinasi, and therefore I did not destroy the Jewish nation in my anger, in my zealousness. Right? Lochein emor, therefore, go and tell him. Hineni noisein lo yas bris Yisrael, I'm rewarding him, I'm giving him the covenant of peace. What is the peace? What was the reward? Interesting, it's called a covenant of peace. And you know, this is the only place in the Torah where a letter has to be split. You know that. The Vav of Shalom has a cut in it. Right? You can even see it in the Chumash, I think. No, not this Chumash. Oh. The article doesn't show it. Most Chumashim show it. In the Torah, the Vav of Shalom has a break in it. And every other letter of the Torah, if that happens, the Torah, Sefer Torah is invalid. It's possible. Right? You just put it away, take a new one. In this word, it has to be there. Right? It has to be. It's called a Vav Ketia. It's got to be a broken Vav. And the reason is that sometimes you have to break peace to achieve peace. Right? The action of Pinchas was not a peaceful one, but his motives were peaceful. His motives was to stop a war, was to stop a plague, was to restore calm, was to create cohesiveness and focus among Klal Yisrael to all serve the same God. So he achieved peace. He was rewarded with a covenant of peace, but his action was not a peaceful one. Sometimes that's okay. Sometimes you have to break peace in order to achieve peace. Shalom, the word Shalom, Brisi Shalom, end of Pasuk 12, end of Pasuk Yudbeis. It doesn't show on the article for some reason, I don't know. A little thing has a note on the side. That's a note on the side that says, if you look at the side, it says Vav Ketia, in small little tiny, no, on the side over there. It says Vav Ketia, it's a broken Vav, yeah? That's okay. And therefore, what is the present? Present was an interesting present. V'hoitzelel ezara achra biskunas oylam. I'm going to give him and his children the present of becoming a Kohen. So he was made to be a Kohen because he stood up for God and he atoned for the Bnei Yisrael. Now what does it mean he became a Kohen? Wasn't he a Kohen already? He was the son of Elazar Kohen. The answer is simple. That when actually a very fascinating idea. That when God made Aaron and his sons Kohanim, what was made was an interesting thing, that was only Aaron and his children made Kohanim, and all the future descendants to be born afterwards. At that time, Pinchas was already born. So actually, he wasn't a Kohen. He actually wasn't a Kohen. Even though he was the son of Elazar, he was the son of Aaron, right? But Aaron and his sons were made Kohanim, and then all future children. Once they were Kohanim, anyone after was born to them afterwards. But Pinchas was already born, he wasn't made a Kohen, only Aaron and his sons. But at this point, as a reward, he was rewarded with a kahuna, and he was given the gift of priesthood, and he was made a Kohen. Okay. Now, Rashi has a very interesting comment at the beginning of the parasha. Rashi says, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Rashi wants to know, why is it necessary for the Torah to say that he was Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron HaKohen? Right? What was the purpose of that? We know already who Pinchas is. It says in the previous parasha he is. There's no reason to go list his genealogy all once again. Sorry? Yeah, but why? Well, I mean, we know his yichus, right? What was the purpose of the yichus? So Rashi says, because what happened was, after the story of Pinchas, he began to be ridiculed. People sort of spoke about him. He became the subject of Lashon Hara in the community. And the going gossip was this. Did you see Pinchas? Pinchas, who does he think he is already? He came from Yisroi, because through his mother's side, he came from Yisroi. Yisroi was Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law. Who, as Rashi puts it, it comes from the Medrash, who fattened cows for idol worship. Right? Who fattened cows for idol worship. And he thinks that he's such a big guy, and he stood up for God's sake, and he went and killed Zimri and Crosby, he killed the leader of the generation, he killed the leader of Sheev tribe, right? So that's why the Torah gives him big yichas and says, yeah, he might come from Yisrael, did that, but he also comes from Aaron HaKohen, right? He comes from Aaron. He's got big yichas, comes from Elazar, the son of Aaron. But the problem with this Rashi is, what does Rashi mean when he says, why do we say he was ridiculed because he came from Yisrael who fattened cows or calves, he fattened calves actually, right, in order to bring them as sacrifices for idol worship, right? Why don't you say simple, why don't we say people ridiculed him that he came from Yisrael who served idol worship, who was an idol worshiper? What's this whole business about fattening calves for idol worship? What's the idea behind that? So I saw a beautiful explanation, it was like this. We have to understand what they were actually saying. Didn't just He wasn't being ridiculed for his yichus. That wasn't the problem. No one has to have yichus in order to do good things. And everyone understood that, right? What they were saying is something different. They were saying, listen, He killed someone, right? So they started to talk. They started to say, you know what? Cruelty is in his genes. Why is cruelty in his genes? Look at his grandfather. You know what his grandfather did? They weren't worried about the fact that he served idols. They worried about the fact that he fattened cows to shecht them, to slaughter them for idol worship. That's cruelty. Right? He would take his calves, fatten them up in order to kill them for idol worship. That's a sort of a cruel thing to do. Right? So they said, oh, look, that's it. He had a cruel Zayda, that's where he gets it from. He thinks such a big tzaddik. He's got a cruel grandfather. So that's in the genes, and that's why he ended up killing Zimri. He's a guy that walks around with a spear. So what does Hashem do? Hashem says, no, Hashem testifies in the Torah that he's a tzaddik. And in fact, his genes did not come from that cruelty of fattening cows. His genes come from his grandfather, his grandfather Aaron. Now, Aaron HaKohen was known as a symbol of peace. In Pirkei Avos, it says that a person should be from the disciples of Aaron. Aaron, even more than Moshe Rabbeinu, we know, was a person who pursued peace. He would make peace between husband and wife, between enemies, between people. That was Aaron's focus. Spent his life doing that, right? So Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. That's who Pinchas is. Pinchas' genes are Aaron's genes. And therefore Pinchas is a peace-loving person. His action of cruelty was purely for the sake of God. And because of purely for the sake of God, he deserves the covenant of peace, and he deserves the gift of now.
Is that why they named the Pasha after him?
Yeah. What we have to understand out of it is, what essentially took place here, as the Mefarshim point out, was the Jews fell into a very big trap. And as a result, then they were open to a plague that God was punishing them. And they needed to get out of it. They needed what we call a tikkun on two levels. They needed the plague to stop, and they needed to snap out of the cycle of immorality and idol worship. So at the end of the day, who was the person to do it? Pinchas, right? Question is, why Pinchas? Why was he the one to do it? Why did this story have to take place through Pinchas? After all, there were greater people. There were greater people. Right? There was Elazar, his father. And there was Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Aaron had died at this point. Right? So Elazar became the high priest. So there was Moshe Rabbeinu. The hierarchy was Moshe Rabbeinu. There was Elazar. They were the leader of the generation. Why did they do something about it? So, just on the side, there's an interesting little Kotzke Rebbe vort. Kotzke Rebbe once said, not everyone agrees with him on this, but the Kotzke Rebbe once said that Klal Yisrael needs kanoim, they need zealous people. But the zealous people can't be the leaders. Leadership and zealousness are two separate things. Moshe Rabbeinu was the leader, Pinchas was the zealot. You need both, even if the zealot's sincere, but zealousness and leadership don't go together. And he proves it because he says later on, when Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Hashem and says, you've got to appoint a leader, the next obvious choice should have been Pinchas. Right? Pinchas, the guy who saved the whole Klal Yisrael, such a tzaddik, the guy who took action, who was assertive, who showed leadership, and he showed strong strength when he needed to show. Why is he leadership? So as a Kotz Rebbe, he was rewarded, he was a zealot, he was given the ultimate reward, he became a kohen, the whole business, but a leader he couldn't become. So a leader and a zealot are two different people. Alright, so that's Kotz Rebbe. The Munkach Rebbe has a big problem with this. He says it's not true. The leader has to be a zealot. It's a different discussion about leadership. But that could be one reason why it was Pinchas that had to stand up and not Moshe and Elazar. But we have to understand on a deeper level, why did this whole story happen through Pinchas? So let me share with you a very fascinating idea. First of all, in the Zohar it says that Pinchas is a Gilgul of Yitzchak. Pinchas had in him the neshama of Yitzchak. Right? How do you see this? Pinchas and Yitzchak have the same gematria, both 208. Okay? If you spell it right, by the way, you often see Pinchas misspelled without the Yud. But it's supposed to be spelled with the Yud. And Pinchas is gematria 208, so is Yitzchak. It says Yitzchak. Pinchas had it in the neshama of Yitzchak. We also find, however, that Pinchas, the Arizal says, and the Arizal speaks a lot about Gilgulim, about reincarnations, that Pinchas has his origin in Cain, the son of Adam. He wasn't such a fantastic fellow. Right? Cain was a murderer. Cain was the first murderer. Says that Arizal that how where did Pinchas get the ability to kill? From Cain. Because Pinchas and Cain are connected. Okay? Well, Arizal says that the Pinchas' soul was connected to that of Cain. Cain, the son of Adam. So he's connected to Yitzchak and it's connected to Cain.
You've got
Yitzchak's soul. And he also has a spiritual link to Cain.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Right? The son of Adam. Which is where he got his murderous ability from. Right? That's what the result says. Slowly, we'll take and put this all together. I'll show you an interesting picture in a minute. Right? So we have to understand. Hold on a second. Cain didn't do it so well. Cain murdered wrongly, evilly. Right? So what do you mean Pinchas never with Cain? Second of all, how does Yitzchak and Cain come together over here exactly? Right? What is this all about? So, let's understand the background to this whole story. Where were the Jews when this whole story happened? They were in Shittim, right? They were at their highest level of spirituality when this all happened. Why? The Jews came out of Mitzrayim, they received the Torah, they gave it over to the next generation, they spent 40 years in the Midbar, right? They're on the bank, the riverbanks of Yarden. They're about to go into Eretz Yisrael. This is a nation that has just spent, most of them have just spent years and years, some of them 40 years. But whoever's there has spent years and years in a Midbar existence. Now let's understand what the Midbar existence is. Right? When we spoke about this before, this is the whole issue of the Meraglim. The Midbar existence was an existence of purity, complete purity, spirituality. Torah, right? A spiritual existence. Yep. Learned Torah all the time, had shiurim from Moshe Rabbeinu, had no connection with the spiritual world, with the physical world, I mean. Didn't have to do cook, didn't have to do laundry, didn't have to work for a living, didn't have to plow, didn't have to sow the fields. No, didn't have to cook, imagine that. Eh? Right? Nothing. Total spirituality. Right? Suddenly, they come to Shittim. Shittim was a bridge, was a middle ground, so to speak, between the existence in the Midbar and between going into Eretz Yisrael. They're about to go into the land of Eretz Yisrael where the whole existence is suddenly going to change. All right, we have to stop and think what this means for them. They're suddenly going to change their entire lifestyle. They're going to be thrown into a lifestyle where they have to suffer. No, not only suffer, they have to be challenged for parnasa. They got to work for a living. They got to plow the fields. They got to do. They got to reap. They got to sow. They got to everything mundane and physical that people have to do. Suddenly, they have to do, right? Now we take these things for granted, but they would just live for 40 years without doing this, right? Want to answer?
Yeah. If they're at the height of their spirituality when they're in Shittim and they just come out of. How are they so easily in time?
Yeah, so we're going to get to that. That's the point we're trying to make.
Okay, right?
So the word Shittim actually means to deviate, do you know that? Which is the same word as shtus, which is foolishness. When a person is a shaita, an idiot, a fool, it's because he deviates from the logical path, right? That's why, you know, the woman who's a soita, the suspected woman that we have read about, it's the same reason. It says, kisishta ishtai, when his wife deviates, goes away from the modest way. Same, all the same word, right? So they come to a place of Shittim, where they first, God gives them a little bit of a glimpse of what it is to deviate from the spiritual experience. And they actually fall apart. They can't handle it.
After how long were they in the
Midbar? 40 years. Because they 40 years of spiritual experience, but never been exposed to what they were suddenly exposed to. Suddenly they get exposed, and it all falls apart. It all falls apart badly. Right? No, God exposes them to this experience, right?
Well, the
daughters of Midian come in, and this is the whole idea.
So it was kind of a setup.
Almost like a setup, because this was part of the preparation to go into Israel. We'll see in a second. We'll see in a minute. But it temporarily doesn't work. In other words, they were spiritual, they'd been involved in, what were they doing for 40 years? They were studying Torah, and that was, their reality was Torah, right? And suddenly, they weren't able to apply that Torah to reality, and they fall apart, right? spiritual beings, but as soon as we become exposed to... By the way, that's a very similar thing to what happened to Adam HaRishon in the very beginning of creation. We once had a whole shiur on this. Same thing happens to Adam HaRishon. Created by God, purity. But as soon as tempted, as soon as challenge sets in, boom, it all goes wrong. Okay.
Sorry, how long were they
cheating? I don't know. They were there for a while. I don't know, a few weeks. I don't know exactly. Whatever it was, right? And they fall apart. Now. Yep. So, they fall apart. Why do they fall apart? Because such is the nature of Torah. You see, Torah, we know the Gemara says, Torah is a symbol of spirituality, but Torah can be as destructive as it can be helpful, depending on how you use it. Torah can destroy a human being. The Gemara says like this, that Torah is an amazing thing. Torah is zoch. If a person merits, the Torah becomes a potion of life. If a person doesn't merit, Torah can become a poison. The very same Torah can become a poison, because if you use it wrongly, the Torah is never affected, but it can be used badly in a person, and when you abuse the Torah, when you use it wrongly, right, it becomes an incredibly destructive element. Now this idea is actually reflected in a very fascinating Zohar. The Zohar says like this, because you know we learned the pasuk before, it says, Vayar Pinchas, Pinchas saw, right? So it says, what did he see? It says the Zohar, he saw a floating mem, the letter mem. Right? Floating mem. What's a mem? Mem is a symbol of Torah. Or, you know, we often have, 40 is a symbol of Torah. The Torah was given in 40 days. Right? The word teruma we have is Torah mem. Right? So the mem, the letter mem is very often a symbol of Torah. The Torah Shabbat Peh, you know, the Mishnah starts with a mem. Right? Etc. So mem is very often the symbol of Torah. So it says that Pinchas saw a floating mem and he was worried. I'll tell you what the Zohar says and I'll explain to you what it means. The Zohar says he was worried, Pinchas was really worried that it was going to attach itself to two letters, the letter of Vav and Sof. Alright, stay with me, you'll see this, what this means in a second. What's Vav and Sof? If you put mem and Vav and Sof together, then Vav and Sof becomes... mem vav sof becomes the word mavis, which means death. Right? Now, where does the vav sof come in? So, let me show you something fascinating. Go to the beginning of the Chumash, the beginning of human beings' downfall, when Adam HaRishon sins. Oh. Right, page 14. Two lines on the bottom. Alright, two lines on the bottom. When the snake entices Chava to eat from the forbidden fruit, it says, Vatere ho'isha, and the woman saw the fruit that it was delicious. First downfall. She looked where she shouldn't have looked, right? When you look at something... The Gemara says, when you look at something evil, that's the first stage of temptation. Then what it says, okay, she saw that it was good, what does she do next? Vatikach mipirya. She takes from the fruit, right? What does she do with it? Vatoichal, she eats. Next one, look at the next word, over the page, vatitein. She gives it to her husband, right? And then the next pasuk is, vatipokachno einei shneim, and they both open up their eyes and they see that they're naked. So go back a second. Look at the word vatera, she saw. Vatikach, she takes. Vatoichal, she ate. Vatitein, she gives. Vatipakachna, her eyes open up. What are the first two letters of each of those words? Vav and Sof. Right? Vav and Sof. What's the symbolism of Vav and Sof? So it says in Kabbalah that Vav is a letter that comes down. Starts on the top and comes down. You draw something down. What's Tof? Tof is the last letter of the Alabes. You bring down something to a lower level, right? So all the stages of temptation to see, to take, to speak, to look, to give, to eat, right? This is the beginning of, you know, the Mefarshim, I speak at length here, this is all the beginning of human downfall. So Pinchas sees, he sees the mem floating in the air, he sees the Torah. But he's worried that the Torah, he sees what's going on, he sees the Torah is being abused, the Torah is being drawn to the letters, Vav and Sof, it's being drawn instead of the passion of Torah, instead of the wisdom of Torah, being something of of a passion that a person uses to be able to elevate himself spiritually, the Torah is being abused. It's being used. It's being drawn down into temptation. It's being drawn down into immorality. It's being drawn down to vav and sof. The consequences of that are disastrous. Mem, vav, sof. You put the mem together with the vav and the sof, it's moves. It makes death. So what did he do? He decided to demonstrate how Torah needs to be used. It says the Zohar, what he did was he took the mem, and he schlepped it away from the vav and the sof, and he brought it to his number. He brought it to 108. If you put the mem with 108, the gematria of Pinchas is 108, right? And the gematria of Yitzchak is 108. 208, I mean, I said. 208, right? And he took the mem of 208, which is Yitzchak. He took the power of Yitzchak that was in him. I'll explain what Yitzchak means in a minute. He took the power of Yitzchak was within him. And he put the mem together. What does the mem and 208 make? Roimach. The spear, the sword. To stop that happening, to kill it off, to stop that plague happening, and to reverse the cycle. That's what the pasuk means. Vayar Pinchas. Pinchas saw and he took the spear. Says Zohar, what did he see? Okay, he saw what was happening on a simple level, but he saw the mem. He saw the mem being attached to the vav and the sof. That's a disaster. Mem vav sof makes moves. So he took the mem to himself, to the power of Yitzchak, and he made it 208 plus mem, which is roimach, which is the spear, and he put an end to it. What did he do spiritually? What does that mean? What did he do? Torah is big, eh? Torah is big. What does that mean? What does it mean? That's nice on a numerology level. What does it mean? What does it mean actually? What does it symbolize? What does he do? So let's go back now to what the Zohar says, that Pinchas was is Yitzchak, or Pinchas is also Kayim, right? Mm-hmm. Now also let's combine that with what we spoke about before. That Pinchas has dual yichus. On one side, his great guy, he comes from all the way from Aaron HaKoy, you can't get better than that. On the other side, Zayda was a bit of a galach. I mean, it's a bit hard, yeah? So he's got this dual thing. He's Kayin and he's Yitzchak. He's coming from Avodah Zorah and he's Aaron. How does it come together? So Pinchas demonstrated to Jewish people, he said like this: you live the spiritual existence, but you're not spiritually protected. As soon as you become exposed to Shittim, you fall apart. What you have to do is, when you're going to be exposed to Shittim, when you're going to go into a land of Eretz Yisrael, which is mundane, which you're going to have to be involved in experience, in mundane experience of material existence, and that's going to be a different kind of lifestyle, you've got to connect to a greater degree of strength and a greater degree of spiritual force. What's that spiritual force? That's the force of Yitzchak. The force of Yitzchak is that Yitzchak, we know, never left Eretz Yisrael. Yitzchak was the symbol of absolute holiness. Avraham Avinu came, right? Yitzchak was incredibly holy. Yitzchak was called a korban. He was an olat tzmimah. Pinchas said to Jewish people like this. He took the sword and he said to them, listen, I want you to know like this. I come from two backgrounds. I'm Yitzchak, and I was about this incredible spiritual energy in me, but I also come from Kayin. I've got a murderous tendency, which could be used for ulterior motives, could be used in an egocentric way. I come from Aaron, who is a peace-loving person, and I come from Yisroi, who fattened cows in a moment of cruelty for the man of the desert, right? I need to show you, you need to learn, Pinchas was the model of how to combine both things together. I need you to learn how to use the purity, how to use the holiness to protect you, that to connect the holiness to the Kayin and to the Yisroi so that it's channeled correctly. When Pinchas used his Yitzchak within him, then he used his murderous ability for total holiness. He did have Kayin in him, he had a murderous ability. Not everyone, you know, a squeamish guy wouldn't go in and kill two people in a tent, right? He could do it. He had that physical strength to do it. He had that stamina to do it. But it was totally pure. Why? Because he took the vulnerable parts of him and harnessed it on to the purity correctly. Right? He showed how it can be done properly. And therefore, when the Torah says he had Kai in him, he had Yisrael, but when he killed, that murderous ability was totally holy. That quest to squash the plague was totally peace loving. It had no cruelty in it, nothing. It was totally for Hashem's sake. He took any bit of personality and trait that he had within him and channeled it completely in the right direction. Right? So therefore, that's why it had to be Pinchas who made that tikkun. Couldn't it be Moshe and Elazar? Moshe and Elazar were great people. They were just holy people, straight holy people. They didn't have the combination. Right? It had to be Pinchas. Pinchas who had both in him. He could demonstrate to the people, you've had a spiritual experience of 40 years, you're now going into another camp, you need to learn how to harness those two camps together. You're not doing it well. Let me show you how to do this. You've got to harness the mem. Your Torah that you learn has got to be connected to the inner spirituality of Yitzchak and remain completely pure, so that it becomes a roimach, it becomes a symbol of a spear, a symbol of strength that you're able to curtail, you're able to stop any amount of temptation and immorality and not sink to the depths. That's why he took the mem away from vav and sof. He took it away from temptation. It didn't become mavis, it didn't become death, and he channeled it so it became roimach, it became a symbol of strength and a symbol of spear, that it would be able to teach them how to handle this whole process correctly. Okay.